All right. Yes, indeed. 62 years old. I'm 65. Okay. And it used to bother me, the whole idea about being in my 60s. I guess it shouldn't. But one person told me, he said, you know, you're at the top of your game. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's biblical. You know, they counted all the men that could go to war, and they counted them in the Old Testament from age 20 to age 60. And he said, so you're just a little over the hill, not very much. And I said, well, that's good. I'm not over the hill. Well, I am, but not, you know, kind of up there, okay? I'm there. And I'm thankful for every bit of energy and health that I have, being able to do whatever I can do. I had a heart attack about a year and a half ago. Maybe you knew that, maybe you didn't, I don't know. But life-flighted to Charlotte. There was a Widowmaker, 100% blockage right at that one spot. And they said 4 more minutes and I'd have been gone. People there saved my life, really. And you know, now he's given me my life back. I just want to use it for him, you know. So I'm at the top of my game, okay? I don't know if that's what you're supposed to say or not. But anyway, I'm thankful. I'm really thankful to the Lord for that. Okay, the passage we're going to start out in, and that's all it's going to be, just a start out here, and that's going to be Mark chapter 16. Mark chapter 16. I have some things to give you tonight that I hope will be an encouragement to you. I'm thankful for the opportunity. Boy, you know, this is nice, okay? For me personally, I'm able to get out and rub shoulders with other people out away from a college setting. And that, for me, builds me up in a big way. Now, mind you, I get out in some other churches and the like around, but this is special, and I really appreciate the opportunity. You have to know that, okay? In Mark chapter 16, you know what 15 says. And he said unto them, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. But when you look down to verse 19, it says, so then after the Lord had spoken unto them, he was received up into heaven and sat on the right hand of God. Okay, that covers the 40 days, and that covers, you know, the ascension of the Lord and the fact that he is seated at the right hand of the Father. That covered that in that one verse. But then verse 20 says, and they went forth and preached, and I like the next phrase, everywhere. The Lord working with them and confirming the word with signs following. Amen. Now, I believe the Bible, and I believe that when it says that they went everywhere, that they went everywhere. And there's other verses in the New Testament that indicates that. Romans chapter 1, for example, and Galatians 1 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 talks about the degree to which the early Christians went and evangelized the world. And we are talking about the world. We're not talking about just the Roman Empire world. They went far beyond that. I mean, you had men that you know, like Simon the Zealot, he went clear across North Africa and then dropped down all the way to Mauritania, on the Atlantic coast of Africa. You had, you know, like Thomas going into India, and you know, we could go on and on talking about the different ones. But beyond just those, there were the other normal, regular Christians that just went everywhere, and they could go everywhere. Sometimes we get the idea that travel was difficult, that, you know, the whole idea of coming to the new world was something that would have been an impossibility. I don't know if I've used this here or not, but about a year and a half ago, I was on Fox News, and a lot of times I'll check the science section and check the archaeology section. I do teach Bible geography and archaeology at the college, and so I try to stay up on that. And here was an article there about a Roman vessel that is, the underwater archaeologists are excavating in the harbor of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And they figured that this thing went down there about 200 BC. So, you know, you've got some people that were traveling around a good bit long before. And I don't want to get into that too deep, but the proof is just there everywhere. You know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. We all know that. And so he discovered America. But, you know, there was the Dark Ages. What we really ought to say is that we rediscovered Europe, rediscovered America. And I'm just telling you, I think that they went everywhere. I think there wasn't anywhere that they did not go. There were caravan routes that went across in the Sahara. They could go up the Nile. They could take the beginnings of the Silk Road all the way to China. I mean, this is something that was done. They just went. It says they went forth and preached everywhere. And, you know, how were they able to do that? It wasn't just that they had the power of the Holy Spirit, which they did, but it had to do with a degree of dedication that the Christians of the first century had in, about this thing about keeping the Great Commission. When their Lord told them, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature," they took it serious. They didn't go, "Oh yeah, that would be good, but there, it's really hard to go here, and it's really hard to go there, and it's really hard to do this or that." They just were, I don't know if you call them dumb enough to believe that God would go with them wherever they went, and they just went. And God did work with them, like it says there, the Lord working with them. Okay? Now, that's my jumping off spot. Okay? And I want to illustrate this by talking a little bit of missionary history. Okay? And this goes back to 1792, and the first mission agency in the English-speaking world, first Baptist mission agency in the English-speaking world, was established over in England. A bunch of, not a bunch, 13 Baptist pastors in the Northamptonshire, grouping there, 13 pastors got together. And with William Carey's influence, they decided to form a mission agency, and it was the first one. And after that, everybody copied after them and all the other mission agencies. In a sense, Bio has copied after them as well. A bunch of pastors getting together and sending some missionaries out. And that was a very momentous occasion. 1792, what are we looking at there? We're looking at, what, 220-some years now? Maybe my math's off, I'm not sure. I mean, I was having trouble figuring, you know, when I first met John, I do remember that he was somewhat of a little kid, but how old are you, John? How old are you now? 50. You're 50. And that would have been in 1976, so I wonder how old you were in 1976. Okay, well, yeah. You know his son? Okay, that's what he looked like at that time. But it doesn't seem like it's been 40 years, brother. It just doesn't. I don't know. Time gets away too fast on that. But I'm not good at math, particularly when somebody asks me just like that, okay? Anyway, I want to talk about that particular event. And I want to talk about one of those pastors. Because tonight, I'm really emphasizing, I know we have missionaries here, but I'm really preaching more to the pastors who are here. And I know that all of you who are here, I'm probably preaching to the choir because you're interested in missions already. And maybe this would be the kind of a message that we ought to preach to a whole bunch of pastors. But nonetheless, that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. And I hope it'll be an encouragement to you. I'm going to preach about a man by the name of Samuel Pierce. He's not very well known, but he ought to be, is my point. I've started doing some research about that founding of that mission agency in October of 1792. And I started doing some background on some of those men, those 13 men, the men that held the ropes, so that William Carey could go out and do the work, the men that really established things. And maybe some of these names are familiar to you, men like Andrew Fuller or John Sutcliffe, people like that. I mean, I don't know if they would be or not, but Ryland was another one. But it is an interesting study. And I came across this guy, and I found out that there was a book written about his life. And so I got on the computer and I tried to find a copy of it, and I finally found one I could purchase over in England. From England, it would come from England, and so I purchased that, and it came, and I read it, and I'm telling you, it really changed my whole attitude about what a pastor ought to be doing when it comes to this matter of missions. When I first got it, I thought, well, this will be sort of like a missionary biography, but what it ended up being was more a biography of a pastor with a missionary heart. You see, this man was involved in the first sending of the missionaries, the founding of that board in 1792. But then a few years later, he himself attempted to go as a missionary and was providentially hindered from doing so. And then, basically, after that, he wore himself out, making sure that others could go if he couldn't. And that's the kind of person that he was. So let me tell you a little bit about this man. And I have to weave his story in with William Carey's story and the story of the First Baptist Mission. I hope I won't lose you as I go along. Let's make this like a class. If I really am losing you, you can raise your hand and ask a question, okay? But I don't want to lose you if something is not being clear there. Let me tell you about this man, Samuel Pierce. He was born July the 20th in 1766. In the busy port city of England, Plymouth, England. It was just about the busiest port there was at that time. Ships coming and going all the time. His father, William Pierce, was a silversmith, and he was a deacon in the Plymouth Baptist Church that was there. And so from the time he was a little boy, he was off there in church. His mother had died just very shortly after he was born. And so with his father working, he basically was raised by his grandparents. And they lived nearby. When he was 8 years old, he went to school. And when he was 13, then he became an apprentice to his father. Now, mind you, at that time, Plymouth was not only busy, it was also the location where many of the supply ships and many of the troop ships of the English were departing from England to go fight against George Washington and those wicked Americans, you know. And so it was the war years. And he said that he would often go down on the docks and he would watch those ships going out and wondering where they were going and the soldiers in their bright red uniforms and the like. And it really put sort of a thrill into him about that. His pastor was a man by the name of Philip Gibbs, who very faithfully preached the Word of God. And as a result of that, when he was 16, he got saved. And it wasn't the pastor that led him to the Lord. Instead, it was a summer intern, a man who was 18 years old by the name of Isaiah Britt. And this guy was studying at the Baptist Training School in Bristol, England. It was called Bristol Academy. It was never a large school. When Pierce later went there, they only had 16 students. But it was where they were training the Baptist pastors. And that's where this Isaiah Britt had come out for the summer and as an intern. And he made friends with Samuel Pierce and was able to lead him to the Lord. And the zeal of this Isaiah Britt was something that was there. I mean, it was something that attracted Samuel Pierce to the point that he shortly thereafter gave his life to become a pastor too. Okay, so the importance of having interns in your church, okay? You can see that even in that part of it. And missionaries, may I say to you, I have students that need to do internships, and I try to place them with missionaries I know. And since you're getting to know me and I'm getting to know you a little bit, maybe you might want to have one of our interns come out for a summer. They have to do 8 weeks, and we want them not just to be on vacation. We want them to really work at it. So if you want somebody, you let me know, okay? And I'll see if I can arrange something on that. We scatter out all over the world whenever it comes time for internships. But anyway, that's what happened. So in 1783, on his 17th birthday, he was baptized. And shortly thereafter, that Isaiah Britt became the assistant pastor of the Plymouth Baptist Church. Then he said to young Samuel, come on, let's go preach. And they would go out and they would preach in little villages here and there, and they just preached all around every bit they could. When he was 19 years old, then his church licensed him to become a student and a preacher, and they recognized his call to preach, and boom, off he went. Off he went to Bible college in that way. One thing that really led him somewhat towards missions at this time was the departure of the first fleet going to Australia. Maybe you know about that. I didn't know about much about it till just a few years ago, but it sort of happened like this. The English government had the United States as a colony, and then they lost the colony in 1783, okay? Then they're thinking to themselves, whoa, what are we going to do with all these people? I mean, we need them to go to another colony. And Australia had been discovered, but nobody from England was living there yet. And they had all these vessels that were in the harbors where their prisons were full of debtors. And they were using vessels, ships, as debtors' prisons. And they decided, well, why don't we just send them over to Australia? And so they made up this big fleet, and that thing was made there at Plymouth and was sent out on its way to Australia, and they sailed into Botany Bay, and they were the first settlers of what became Australia. It's called the First Fleet. He wrote about that he had such a desire to go with them because he realized that those people would need the preaching of the Word of God. And so there was a sense in which he had leaning towards missionary service even at that time. Well, he went to college. August 1786, there were 16 students. They met in a big house in Bristol. They had all kinds of rules. There was a 10 o'clock curfew, and if you came in after 10 o'clock, you were fined 1 shilling. And so the students tried to devise all kinds of ways to sneak around that so they wouldn't be caught and be fined the 1 shilling. And yes, you know, Pierce was one of those kind of guys. And so, but you know, he was also, the students were out preaching on virtually every weekend. And it wasn't long before in Birmingham, there was a church, a fairly sizable church for that day. It's called the Cannot Street Baptist Church. Now, how would you like to have a church that's the Cannot Church, you know? I don't think that'd be a good one, okay. But you do know we have some funny names in Baptist history. The first English Baptist church was pastored by Thomas Helwys, and he's founded it in London in 1712, and it was the Spitalfield Church, okay. So I don't know if they named it for the Baptist preacher or not, but anyway. There's some interesting names that come. Okay, anyway, that church was 50 years old and was running almost 200 people. And he had 1 year yet to go in college when the pastor had to step down because of illness. And because he'd been preaching around and had preached for them, they asked him to do pulpit supply in that church. So he was very young. Nonetheless, he did that. And then, next thing you know, they called him to be the pastor. And so he was pastor of that church in Birmingham. So, 24 years old in 1790, he was ordained. Robert Hall, his professor at the college, preached the ordination service, and he was worried about the fact that Pierce was young. And so he preached to all the church people there and the other Baptist pastors. A simple title for his sermon was, I don't know where it is in the Bible, but it's this, Encourage Him. That was the title of his sermon. And if I'm ever asked to do any other Baptist ordination councils or something like that to preach, I'll probably use that as my title, Encourage Him. I felt like he needed to be encouraged. There were some initial problems in the church, but it wasn't long before those were settled. and he was doing okay. And when he was finally settled as a pastor on a regular salary, he met a young lady, and her name was Sarah Hopkins. And they got married in February of 1791. So he was ordained in August of 1790, got married in February of 1791, 6 months into his ministry. And after he married her, he baptized her. She had just recently been coming to the church. And so he baptized her after that. So any of you have the opportunity to baptize your wife? Nobody here? I didn't either. Okay, so, but that was something that happened. Okay, anyway, y'all still with me, right? There really is a purpose to this message. I do have 5 points, okay? I'm just not there yet, okay? All right, you bear with me. But now this thing about his missionary heart, it really started to develop. One of the first things he did when he became a pastor there in 1791, and mind you, the mission was formed in October 1792. So this was, 1790, he was ordained, married in 1791. He's still very young. But he really began to think about that. He himself, right there at that church in Birmingham, began a monthly meeting for revival and the spread of the gospel. Now that sounds like something that would be just natural for any of us to do, but you have to understand his times. You see, these people were particular Baptists. You had two kinds of Baptists in England at that time. You had the general Baptist, and you had the particular Baptist. The general Baptist, they were Arminian in doctrine, and the particular Baptist, they were Calvinistic in doctrine. And we still have some of that debate going on around. I don't know where you are on that, but I'm thinking you're probably not on the Calvinist side of things. I'm definitely not. I don't think you can lose your salvation either. Okay, but there's a good pastor friend I have in Wilmington, North Carolina, Pastor Rudy Shepherd. I don't know if any of you know him or not. He has the 630 broadcast on Fundamental Broadcasting Network. I don't know if you get that out here or not. Any of you get FBN? Do you have that at all? Do you? Okay, you know what I'm talking about. Fundamental Broadcasting Network out of Elizabeth City, North Carolina. They put our kind of people on it. They only have preachers that preach from the King James. They're independent Fundamental Baptists. They have a network of radio stations around, and he's one of the preachers on there. Anyway, Rudy Shepherd himself was raised in the Tidewater area of North Carolina, and that was the Baptist churches that were out there. They came from the general Baptists that came over from England long ago, and many of those were where your free will Baptists come from, where you can lose your salvation. Okay, but Rudy, he got that right because he said, I had to read the Bible, and I got to Romans chapter 8, and I figured out that, when you get saved, there is now therefore no condemnation, and that means that you have eternal life, see? And anyway, but that was going on in England. These were particular Baptists, and they were strong Calvinists. However, there were some younger men that were starting to move away from that strict position at that time. There was one by the name of Andrew Fuller that actually wrote a book about it, and he was condemned by many of the older Baptist pastors, particularly a guy by the name of Gill. And so the Baptists in England, the particular Baptists, divided into two camps. You had the Gillites and you had the Fullerites, even though they didn't want to use that term necessarily, but it ended up being what people could call it. And the Fullerites, they were still Calvinistic, but they were really very evangelistic. And see, Andrew Fuller was a really close friend to William Carey, and he was the secretary of that mission agency that got started there in 1792. Okay, so you kind of get that as a background here. So for a young preacher 200 miles away in Birmingham, that's how far it was from where the mission agency got started, 200 miles away, for him to even start a monthly meeting for revival and spread of the gospel meant that He was not of the Gilite persuasion that he was of the Fullerite persuasion at that time. He heard through the grapevine about William Carey's views. Now, I'm going to have to stop here and talk a little bit about William Carey. William Carey, you know, started out as a shoemaker, very poor, married a sweet lady by the name of Dorothy who could not read, you know, and he tried to support his family as best he could, making shoes, but he'd gotten saved and gotten into a church, and after that, little by little, he gravitated from an independent church into a Baptist church, and he became like a lay preacher, and then he actually became a pastor himself. But he never made much money. I'll make reference to that again in just a moment. None of them did. They were as poor as church mice, these Baptist pastors, okay? But Carey had gotten under the burden for missions, and he began to talk about it to everybody. People that would come in his shop, he would talk about it. Some of the pastors that he fellowshipped with, he'd talk about it. And there was this deacon, a man by the name of Thomas Potts. Thomas Potts was a businessman. He had just come back from America. He actually had gotten run out of New Orleans and New Orleans, however you want to say it. Okay, but he got run out of, I'm from Cincinnati. And we usually say New Orleans, and we say Chicago instead of Chicago, and we say Illinois. You know, I don't know, we're weird. And we also say Washington, and you wash your clothes. That's Cincinnati, okay? All right, but anyway, the thing is that he was over there on business, and he started witnessing to many of the slaves that were on the plantations, and he got so many of them saved that the plantation owners run him out of town. And so he came back, was fresh coming back to England, needed some shoes or something, came in, was talking with William Carey. William Carey shared his burden. And Thomas Potts told him, if you'll write it out as a pamphlet, I'll pay to print it. And then, you know, Carey started trying to write this, and he made several drafts of it. He talked to different people, and he shared it with people. And eventually that became what is known as a very famous document, The Inquiry. The inquiry that where he was making an inquiry whether it is right to use means in order to evangelize the heathen, which again, thinking about the times where there was so much deep hyper-Calvinism that was there among those churches, is it right for us to use means in order to evangelize people was what he was proving. And it's very well written. If you've never read a copy of it, you can get that on the internet and read it. It's not very long. But Potts paid for that, and then it got to be talked about in Baptist circles. So now come back to Samuel Pierce. Samuel Pierce, down 200 miles away in Birmingham, he hears about this, and he says to himself, I've got to go to that pastor's meeting up there in Northamptonshire, and I've got to meet this William Carey. And so 200 miles by horseback, that took you more than, you just didn't hop in the car and go down the interstate. It took you a couple, 3 or 4 days to get there, you know? But nonetheless, that's what he did. He went there in May of 1792 for the pastor's meeting. They met twice a year. They met in May and they met in October. And when he came in there, he met William Carey for the first time, met all those people for the first time, really. And he was talking with Carey about it, was so interested in what he was saying that he said Carey invited him to come over to his room and he would read the inquiry to him and explain it. They stayed up all night, and they just the two of them talking missions, and they stayed up all night where he went point by point through the five chapters of what he had there in that inquiry. He wrote later that that you know his heart was moved by that, and he was convinced that they as Baptists should do something to use means to evangelize the rest of the world. So the next day they had their preaching in the morning, and they had their business meeting in the afternoon. Sounds familiar, right? They did all that kind of thing, and towards evening, they had another preaching session, and then they were going to adjourn. And Carey stood up and he said to the men that are there, gentlemen, We have talked about this thing of trying to do something, to actually do something, not just talk about it, but to do something. Is nothing to be done? I mean, are we to table this again and not do anything? And so sort of as a last minute thing, the men got together there and they said, all right, we will discuss at the next meeting firm plans to form a society that will send missionaries to the heathen. And I mean, you know, this was exciting news to all those men that were there. And so it was they went home and they talked about it and prayed about it. And they came back together October the 2nd of 1792 at Kettering. They formed a society. And he had a young man that he brought with him when he went to that meeting. He went to the meeting. Samuel Pierce did. The young man's name was William Staunton. Okay, now that's a name you ought to know too. S-T-A-U-G-H-N? S-T-A-U-G-H Staunton? T-O-N? I think I got it right. I'm not sure. Anyway, he was a Bible college student that was hanging out with Samuel Pierce, and he said, you got to get up there. We're going to form a mission society. And so William Staunton was a part of that first meeting to form the Mission Society. Shortly thereafter, when the London Missionary Society was founded, and I'll tell you about that in a few minutes, okay? All right, are you all with me? I mean, you're okay, right? You don't mind this kind of preaching? This really isn't preaching, but I'm going to preach in just a minute. I still have 5 points, okay? All right, don't lose that. I mean, I'm going to get to yelling and carrying on in a few things like that in just a few minutes. I'm laying the groundwork. This is the introduction, okay? But anyway, this William Staunton, he was there for the founding of the London Missionary Society, and shortly thereafter, he immigrated to the United States and became pastor of the church in Philadelphia, a Baptist church in Philadelphia. And when Adoniram Judson converted to becoming a Baptist in 1813, and Luther Rice came back from India to interest the Baptist pastors, William Staunton was there for the formation of the first Baptist Missionary Society from the United States and became its first secretary. Later on, he also became chaplain of the Congress of the United States. So he was a very important man. But at this time that I'm telling you about, he was just a Bible college student. Never, ever doubt that Bible college students can do things for the Lord. You don't know what kind of influence you'll have on some of them that they might go ahead and serve the Lord. But anyway, go on ahead here. When they decided who was going to do what, and they decided that William Carey was going to be sent out, and they had all of that there at that meeting. They had a meal at Deacon Beebe's home. He just passed away, so it was Widow Beebe, right across from the Kettering Church. And after the meal, they retired into a small back room in order to have some snuff. Okay, the Baptist pastors in that day were not against doing a little bit of snuffing. Everybody in England did it at that time. I'm sorry, I just have to tell it the way it is, okay? All right, so, our president, George Washington, used snuff, okay? Whole bunches of people use snuff. And the kids are looking at me like, what's snuff? You can ask your parents, okay? You can do that later, okay? But anyway, they're back there, and they decide, they made the final rules and everything for it. And then they passed a box. It was an empty snuff box is what it was. And they passed a box and put subscriptions in it, pledges in it, that they themselves personally were going to subscribe to the support of this new agency. They felt like they couldn't ask other people unless they themselves took the first step. Now, they were able to pull together 13 pounds, 2 shillings, and 6 pence. That's not a lot of money. But most of these guys, I analyzed this, most of these pastors were poor enough. I went through each one of them, what their salaries were and what they were doing. Most of them were poor enough that it averaged out to be 5% of their income. I mean, just to put that in there like that, it was really a very sacrificial. That William Staunton that I talked about, he had no money, so he went to Pierce and he said, hey, can I borrow some? And so he loaned him some and he put an offering in. The only person that was so poor that he could not put an offering in that night was William Carey. He was the one. Okay, but it was an interesting day. Now, Pierce left that meeting. He said, I returned home to resolve to lay myself out for this cause. And so when he got back to his home church, his sermon on Sunday was, guess what? Missions. Explaining what he had seen, what he had felt, what he knew, what he'd been instructed on. It was on missions. On Tuesday, he met with some men from his church, and they formed an auxiliary, cool name, an auxiliary mission agency. It was like they were going to collect funds in their part of England to send it up there to the other Baptist agency for the support of the first missionaries going out. So he was the president, secretary, I guess you would call it, of that auxiliary along with four others. Well, the thing was moving along, and so there was going to be another meeting just at the end of the month, back up again in 200 miles away. And so he made that journey up there to be in that journey, in that. And when he went up there, he had already been able to collect from his church 70 pounds. The pastors had brought together 13 pounds, but he had 70 pounds. And this was the first church missionary offering to that agency, the first missionary offering of its kind from a church, not an individual, that went to Baptist English missions, okay? And his church was the first one. There was another meeting on November the 13th. There was another meeting in January of 1793. He went to all of those meetings. More and more getting excited over the fact that John Thomas and William Carey, there were two of them that were going to go out. You hear more about Carey than anybody else. And he was he had written in his diary this phrase, I will go anywhere and do anything to advance this cause. And you know what they were doing? You know what all these pastors did? Okay, you ready for this? You ready for this? You ready for this? Carey did no deputation. The pastors did the deputation. They went around to the other Baptist churches and told them that they were sending out some missionaries and that if you wanted to be a lowlife, you won't support it, but if you will get behind this, you better, because we're about to send them out. And they did. And incidentally, most of these pastors not only had their own home church, but they would preach out in preaching points. I said something about that last night, didn't I? Okay, preaching points in little villages that were within walking distance of where their pastor was. They did this all the time. And so when it came time for William Carey and John Thomas to depart, he was able to meet them in London, and he himself personally, this would be the monies that Pierce had collected. He'd collected an additional 127 pounds, 10 shillings, and 10 and one quarter pence. And he delivered that to the mission in order to help Carey get on his way. Right then, as they were about to leave, Carey turned to Samuel Pierce, and he said to him, well, you will come after us, won't you? And it was a shock to Samuel Pierce. And the only reason that Carey said that to him was because it was so obvious that his heart was really in this mission endeavor. And so Carrie just naturally said that to him. I don't know if he was really serious about it or not. But when he made that statement, you know, Samuel Pierce went home and he said, he wrote in his diary, when he said that, my heart said, amen. That's what his heart said. During 1793, after Carrie had left, he wrestled in prayer about it, he said in his diary. I was often begging God either that he would take away the desire to go or open a door for its fulfillment. And he continued to go around preaching to other churches, and he continued to raise funds for the mission to send after, and continued to encourage young men to give themselves to the matter of missions. But he himself wanted to go. In a meeting in September 1794, that when they had been 1 year since they had formed the council, formed that society, Carey's letter had come back. It took 5 months to go out and 5 months to come back. And this was fresh, the first word that they had received. And he described what he had felt, what he had seen there in India, and the great need for India. And he finished the letter by saying, please send help. And there was no one to send. They had nobody to send out. So as they talked among themselves, who can go, who can go, who can go? You got anybody that can go? We ought to send another person behind Carrie to get out there to follow up here. Who can go, who can go? Nobody to send. Pierce said to himself, I want to go like that. So he went back from that meeting, 1793, and he began a one-month private diary in which he was going to write about his soul search to find peace about whether he should go or whether he should stay. And he began that diary, and the diary is very fascinating. Like this entry, October 15th, he wrote, Birmingham, 50,000 people and 10 evangelical ministers. Hindustan, 100 million people and not 10 preachers at all. Why this disproportion? I must go if others will not. That was his desire. He started without telling anybody. He started learning Bengali, and he started learning Sanskrit on the side. He then began learning Hindi, and he began studying Hindu law codes. He thought, you know, there hadn't been a Bible yet. I mean, Carrie hadn't produced a Bible in Hindi yet. So he's, you know, trying to study to do all of this. And it kind of seeped out in his preaching and seeped out what he was doing. So finally, he had to tell his church. he told his church, he said, look, if nobody else is going to go out, I'm going to have to go. I'm surrendering as a missionary. And his church met and without him being in the room, and they discussed this, and they decided as a church, no, you can't go. We like you too much. You cannot leave us. But they did have this one thing that they decided, and they discussed it a long time. They said, if the other pastors said yes, that he ought to go, then they would have to let him go. Okay? So, you see where this is going? He contacted the other pastors. And the immediate answer from Andrew Fuller was no. And the answer from Ryland, the other leader, was no, you can't go. You collect more money than anybody else. We can't let you go. You're our key man down in Birmingham. You're it. You're the auxiliary. We can't let you go. And so their answer was no. On November the 5th, then, he wrote in his diary, well, one thing I've resolved. If I cannot go abroad, I will do all I can to serve the mission at home. That was his resolve. So he went to a November 12th meeting, 1793, it came up again, and all the pastors still said no. They said, there's a good reason. Andrew Fuller's very sick now, and he's the secretary. He handles the finances. And if something happens to him, we need you to step into that position. So we're not going to send you out. You'll probably have to take over. But you know, this didn't come quickly. It wasn't just a snap decision. He had brought two of his deacons with him, and they met all morning. They discussed it all morning, and they had lunch over it. And then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they dismissed Pierce and his two deacons, and they discussed it yet again, and they finally came down to this. For the present, you have to stay here. They were saying, we recognize that you have such a zeal for this, and we do not want to get in the way of God's call. But their decision was, for the present, you stay here. He said, I am so disappointed. That's what he wrote in his diary. It took him 4 months to write a letter to Kerry to tell him that he wasn't coming out. He was just that much overwhelmed by the disappointment that was there. But he rolled up his sleeve and got busy. His church became the home church of two other missionaries that were then picked up by the agency and were sent out to Africa. He became the liaison for the founding of the London Missionary Society. London Missionary Society were the independents. These are guys that had come out of the Anglican Church, and they didn't know what they were yet. Okay, and they were forming the London Missionary Society. And you would know very famous names like Livingston and people like that. They were, London Missionary Society people, okay? But that thing got started in 1795, and they didn't know what they're doing, so they asked the Baptists, well, you guys started already. Can you tell us how you got started and how it's working out? And so he became the liaison for that happening and was there at the first meeting. There was another man that he befriended by the name of William Ward. William Ward was a printer, and by this time, Kerry was starting to do translation work, and Ward had the desire to get out and to do printing, and so he encouraged them to do it, and they became really deep friends, and basically William Ward went on ahead and took the step to go out and work with Kerry because of Samuel Pierce. But he was all the time traveling and speaking everything he could to raise the funds and get these missionaries sent and more to step forward to say that they would be missionaries. But all of a sudden then he started coughing, and in 1797 his health began to fail. He was dealing with tuberculosis. Okay, a lot of people had that. He had trouble preaching, he had trouble traveling, he still did it, he hurt his health in so doing, but he kept doing it. By December of 1798, he had to preach his last sermon just because he couldn't breathe very deeply. He did linger for a while. He didn't die until October of 1799. 33 years old, died of tuberculosis. But even in May of 1799, before that, let me get this all together. He preached his last summer, December 1798. March of 1799, he made his last trip, opening a brand new church, okay? In May of 1799, he could not attend the meeting of the mission agency. There were 6 new missionaries that were being sent out to India at that meeting. One of them was William Ward, and the other one was Jonathan Marshman. If you know anything about missionary history, you know that Kerry, Marshman, and Ward became the Serampore trio, that they worked together for many years, and Kerry did the translating, Ward did the publishing, and Jonathan Marshman did the church planting, and they reached India. I mean, basically, they did so much in doing that. But this was when Ward and Marshman were sent out. He could not attend. Samuel Pierce could not attend. So Fuller said, would you write out a sermon? And he wrote out a sermon, and Fuller stood up, and he read it to those 6 missionaries that were being sent out to India. The entire audience wept when that sermon was read. And then in October 1799, he passed away. 17 days after he had passed away, those 6 new missionaries landed in India. my 5 points. I told you I was going to get there, right? That was all introduction. My 5 points. Number one, Samuel Pierce gave his heart to the Great Commission. He didn't just talk about it, and it wasn't something that was just back burner or a program of his church. It became his burden and his passion that the Great Commission would be filled. And I think that's the reason why I chose Mark 16 as a passage to jump off from, because they took it very serious, so much so that they went forth and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them. But that would be my first point. He gave his heart to missions. Okay, he gave it. My second point is, see, these points will go relatively quickly now, since I spent so long on everything else there, right? So the second point is, he mobilized his church for missions. And he was the first one to do it. I mean, it was his men that formed the auxiliary. It was his men that accompanied him to these meetings. It was his burden given over to his people. And so they gave and they gave and they gave. Incidentally, after he passed away, that guy that led him to the Lord, Isaiah Britt, I think his last name was, he became the pastor of that church and carried on where Pierce had left off. I think that's kind of interesting. The third thing I'd have you see there is that Samuel Pierce raised his voice in the cause of missions. He was not going to be quiet. And the opportunity came for him to encourage the London Missionary Society to get established. That's where he was. And no wonder whenever Adoniram Judson sent Luther Rice back to form the Baptist Missionary Society in America, there was already waiting there a young man who'd been influenced by Samuel Pierce. And that young man, William Staunton, had the same heart that Samuel Pierce had and had been nurtured in the heart of Samuel Pierce and passed on to his young protege, who was now in America. He raised his voice for the cause of missions. Number four, he took responsibility for the funding of missions. Now, did you hear how I said that? I don't know what I'm saying here. I really don't, okay? I don't know what it means for us today is what I mean by that. But he, as a local Baptist pastor, local church pastor, took upon himself the responsibility for the funding of missions. Where did we get deputation? 1930s. Not until the 1930s? No. Not until the 1930s. What happened in the 1930s? Baptist pastors left the mainline denominations and became independent pastors all over the country. They had battles that they had to fight even to be able to keep their property. They had to go before courts and judges. And judges ruled with the local congregation instead of the Northern Baptist or the Southern Baptist Convention, whichever one. But they were independent. Okay, so they're going to try to support some missionaries. How's it going to happen? How are they going to find? They'd been using the convention for years and years. Missionaries showed up on their doorstep. Oh, we'll support him individual. Individual support plan started. So next thing you know, missionaries were coming around to the independent churches, and that's how deputation got started. It was started in the 1930s, 1940s, we had the war. And, you know, it was sort of not the most active time. But you're the 1950s, and you had and then you had the Southwide Baptist Fellowship getting started. You had Lee Robertson and Tennessee Temple. And we go on and on talking about the 50s and the 60s and all like that. It was already an established pattern, and we began to use it. But in those days, deputation didn't take you very long. And there was a lot of interest on the part of many pastors in getting missionaries out there. And somehow in the last few years, it has changed. It's changed instead of the pastors really wanting to get the funding of the missionaries so they can get going, that we have to wait for the missionaries to come and impress us And I'm trying to be very kind and very cautious on what I say here. But you know this, and I know that, that missionaries have to do a certain song and dance in order, can I be so brave as to make that statement? They have to impress a pastor in a church or they don't get support. And I mean, it's like the, I've been a pastor. I've had the phone calls. It hurts like everything to tell somebody you can't support them because you don't have the money. I mean, it's a horrible thing that happens when you have to do it. But I'm just wondering, I'm just talking out loud here. You forgive me. I hope, well, maybe you'll never have me back. But maybe you won't show up tomorrow. I don't know. But forgive me on this if I'm out of line. But I think our pastors have forgotten that the local church is the agent for sending and supporting financially the missionaries that are going out. We have forgotten that. We have waited for them to come to us. In other words, the direction coming from the missionary to the church, when it ought to be from the church to the missionary. Oh, not too long back, I met a missionary that was 100% supported by his home church. I'm like, whoa, never heard of that, you know, but just one, that's all. But you know, I've done deputation. I know all about deputation, and I know what it's like from the pastor side of thing to take the phone calls too. And a lot of people wonder, isn't there some better way? No, deputation actually is a good way. It's not a bad way at all. It's just, I think that pastors ought to get more involved in this. I think we need to really take it to heart that this is a young man, this is his family, they are going out. I really need to take responsibility here. Fourth point, he took responsibility for the funding of missions. And the last one, he made friends of missionaries. No jokes on his part about them being missionaries or something like that. None of those kind of jokes. That wasn't there. They were his closest friends. Is it any wonder then that his oldest son, when he came to age, went out to India and was a printer and replaced William Ward as the printer? Is it any wonder that his daughter, Anna, went out to India and happened to meet a young man by the name of Jonathan Carey, William Carey's son, and they got married. And they stayed out there until she passed away in 1840. And is it any wonder with a man like Samuel Pierce, you see? What are we going to do? Missions are struggling. We can blame the economy. We can blame Washington, D.C. We can blame this or that or whatever. But these were 13 poor country Baptist pastors that got under the burden. And they changed the world. They were the beginning of a great missionary enterprise that we are still having the fruits from, gaining the fruits from. Why can't we do that again? I think we need to do some soul searching. I need to do some soul searching. Is this important enough of a job to really take it as something I should put on the front burner instead of the back burner of my church? Isn't it something that ought to be a little bit more than just a kiss ever so often? I think it is. It's a somber thought. I'm looking forward to meeting Samuel Pierce someday. In his short life, 33 years, he made an impact on this world. He didn't make it to the mission field. But he would have if he could have. if they'd have let them go, let me go, and they kept holding them back, you know, like that. That's a good thing, because he was able to do a lot more in the position he was in than what he could have done going out there with tuberculosis. You see that? So, I got to quit. I don't want to. Okay, I know I got to. I just want you to take it to heart. I brought before you an example of a great man of God, probably someone you've never heard of. I had never heard about it until I was doing some of this research and found that book. And the book is lost in obscurity. Nobody talks about Samuel Pierce. But so far as I know, he is one of our great Baptist heroes and somebody we need to follow. You think about it. Let the Lord deal in your heart about it. Dear Father, you said, go and preach the gospel to every creature. And they did. And they did in 1792 attempt to do it. And they influenced so many people that did it. The 1800s were such a good time for missions, largely because of how God started. You did that work, Lord. You did it in the heart of people like William Carey and William Staunton and Andrew Fuller and John Ryland and Samuel Pierce. You did it in their hearts. Would you do it again? Would you, Lord, stir our hearts? Father, I give the message to you, and I'll let you do with it as you will see fit. But Lord, I would pray for myself that you'll stir my heart anew to give myself to the fulfilling of the Great Commission. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.